Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arizu Mohseni and it's a great pleasure welcoming tonight's guests, Chuck Close, David Gross, and Karina Evangelista. We're here tonight to celebrate the launch of Artifacts Press and the release of a searchable and sortable interactive web publication detailing Chuck Close's iconic photo-based portraits from 1967 to 2012. Artifacts Press is the first company dedicated to the publication of catalog raisonnés and has developed a proprietary patent-pending software platform that can be used for further catalogs. Legendary artist Chuck Close is one of the greatest painters and heroes of our time. He is best known for his highly inventive techniques used to paint the human face and his large-scale photo-based paintings. His work has been the subject of countless exhibitions, with major retrospective shows held at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and other prestigious venues worldwide. He is a recipient of the National Medal of Arts and numerous honorary degrees from prominent institutions.
I don't want him to think I got it from Bush.
Oh, no, that was from President Clinton. Oh, absolutely. A member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, he also serves on the President's Committee for the Arts and the Humanities. David Gross is managing partner and editor-in-chief of Artifacts Press. He previously held a number of positions, including editor-in-chief of artinfo.com and managing literary editor at Grand Street. His writings have appeared in Art News, Modern Painters, Slate, and other major publications. Karina Evangelista is the editor of the Chuck Close Catalog Raisonné. She previously worked in the education and the curatorial departments at the Museum of Modern Art and the Delaware Center for the Contemporary Arts, where she organized several exhibitions. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in this event. I also like to take the opportunity to invite all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from this building, where you can freely browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of art, architecture, and design, including many catalog raisonnés that you can take home. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Hello. I have not memorized what I was going to say. I'm David Gross. I'm the managing partner and editor-in-chief of Artifacts Press, which is a new digital publisher that's launching today. I'm happy to see a lot of people in the audience tonight, and we're especially honored to be joined by Chuck Close, who's the subject of our first catalog raisonné. Before we get to Chuck and his catalog, though, I want to spend a few minutes just talking about this project overall. Artifacts Press began several years ago with two realizations. The first, which is going to probably be obvious to many people in this audience, is that catalog raisonné are hugely important. Each of these comprehensive, exhaustively researched catalogs presents a detailed history of an entire creative life. It's as close as we can come to recreating the arc of a major artist's career. The second realization may be less apparent. We believe that catalog raisonné, though beautiful as books, make more sense in a digital format. And that's why we developed Artifacts Press. We wanted to create a software platform that would facilitate the production of digital catalog raisonné. But our goal is not simply to create more of these catalogs. Our larger vision is to aggregate them onto a single platform to create a virtual art library, a giant database that will allow you to search through multiple catalogs and compare artists to one another. Tonight, we're celebrating the first of these catalogs, Chuck Close paintings, 1967 to the present. The catalog is a complete publication in itself, but it's also a project that will grow over time. We'll expand backwards to show Chuck's early works prior to 1967, and we'll expand forward to include new paintings as Chuck completes them. We'll also expand the catalog laterally to include pieces in other mediums, from drawings to paintings to prints. I want to also mention that we're releasing a second catalog today, Jim Dine's sculpture, 1983 to the present. And we'll be back at the New York Public Library on February 27th to celebrate that release with Jim Dine. After these first two catalogs, our next publications are for Saul LeWitt and Agnes Martin, and we have several more after that to follow. Let me just say a few more words about artifacts. We're a publishing company, but we're also a software company. The technology that we're about to display is patent pending, and it's been developed with the input of artists, artist estates, studio managers, art registrars, and catalog resume editors. Our catalogs are fully searchable, so you can locate and sort artworks according to a wide variety of criteria, ranging from date to medium to ownership history to current location and many more. Our software is extremely flexible, which enables us to meet the particular needs of every artist. We can customize homepage layout, navigation, metadata. We can customize the look and feel of artwork pages. We can create pages for individual exhibitions, collectors, institutions, and series of works. We offer enhanced technology features like full screen and Zoom, and our catalogs are available on multiple platforms like the iPad. Most important of all, our catalogs are every bit the equal of the catalog resume you already know in book form. They're accurate, comprehensive, and authoritative. Behind these catalogs is a user-friendly software platform that we think of as a digital archive. This, too, is extremely flexible and can meet individual artists' needs. While developing this software, we've taken great care to account for security and confidentiality concerns. We're able to store vast amounts of data, including complete libraries of print-quality images, and all of this information can be easily retrieved to power other applications. So that's our technology. The other key aspect of Artifacts Press is our team of art world professionals. Our team includes publishers, designers, web engineers, and copy editors. But our most important staff members are art historians and art researchers. They're the ones who gather information, research provenance, and help determine which works go in the catalog. And tonight, joining me and Chuck is one of these staff members, Karina Evangelista, who's the editor of Chuck's catalog. We're going to get to that catalog in a second, but I want to take a moment to thank the many people who have made contributions to this project. There are many, many people who have participated in this team, and we're deeply grateful to all of them. But I would like to single out two people in particular. Sarah Davidson is assistant editor of Artifacts Press. She's been with us from the earliest stages of the project, and she's contributed enormously to every aspect of its development. Her biggest contribution, though, is as editor of the Jim Dine catalog resume. And Sarah will be up here on stage when we celebrate that catalog on February 27th. The second person I want to acknowledge is Mark Glimcher, the president of Pace Gallery and a founder of Artifacts Press. Artifacts Press is a project that requires vision and patience, two qualities that do not always go easily hand in hand. Mark has both. Every member of the Artifacts team and all the participating artists are deeply grateful to Mark's tremendous commitment to this project. And with that, I'm going to pass this over to Karina, and she will talk, and then we will preview the catalog for you.
In 1985, I was a young teen, and a bug bit me. My sister was graduating from Cooper Union, and my aunt, with whom she was living, sent me a plane fare so I could attend her graduation. This was my first visit to the United States from Manila. My sister was still finishing up her last semester when I arrived, and my aunt was busy at work. They gave me a guidebook to all the museums in New York and told me that with a student ID, I could get into most of them, even the Museum of Locks, for free. So almost every day that summer, I went to a museum. I really had no expectations beyond filling my days. Besides having heard of Picasso and the Mona Lisa, I knew almost nothing about art. I really had no expectations, and this made me the perfect flaneur in the boulevard of art. I had virgin eyes that weren't obscured by the blinders of learned theory or acquired taste. I looked with no preconception about what I was looking at. I didn't walk into a museum going for a beeline for what I wanted to see because they were all there for me, all new for me to see. And the art bug bit me, particularly modern and contemporary. Three things stand out in my memory. Without knowing its illustrious history, I found myself going back to MoMA the most often. With absolutely no idea who Rothko was, I found myself transfixed by a painting of his at the Met. I stood there wondering why this inanimate thing with neither figure nor text held me enthralled, why I couldn't look away. I was puzzled that mere color on canvas could evoke feeling. It was unnerving, almost menacing, because the experience of being captivated by a visual thing I didn't even know to call beautiful was utterly new. Then one weekend, my sister and I took a bus to D.C., where, even without a student ID, anyone could get into the museums. So I walked through the National Gallery of Art, again without any expectations. I just walked and looked. This time, it was a big clot of people in one of the galleries that caught my attention. Not only were they converged in front of it, a number of them were walking backwards from it to move, and then only to move back up close to it. It was... Sorry. It was Fanny, the finger painting that Chuck painted in 1985, which must have been spanking new at that time, because now I actually know it was the second painting he did in that year. Man, did I look. Yes, both up close and from a distance, and again and again. Beyond the initial awe at the realization the looming painting was made with fingerprints, the image itself held a power that exceeded what my teenage mind might have thought simply as cool. And therein lies the strength of Chuck's paintings. He's the magician who actually lays bare his process for all to see, because particularly in his case, it is process that wills form into being. He literally shows you the trick, but the result is so powerful that the knowledge of the cleverness of the method and the realization of the mind-boggling, painstaking commitment to the labor do not dilute the image or the impact of the experience of the image. You become enthralled both to the understanding of the facture and to the image itself. Peter Sheldahl described this perfectly in his essay on Chuck's paintings in the early 90s. He spoke about the ungraspable mechanism at work in Chuck's painting because it is impossible to focus on marks and take in the whole image at the same time. He drew an analogy to Diego Velázquez, who presents the classic case of conspicuous brushwork in tension with crystalline illusionism. Call it tension, paradox, perhaps perfect symbiosis of the most unlikely combinations. A thumbprint that conjures hair or wrinkles. A tablespoon of acrylic paint to cover a 9-foot-high painting. The unmistakable whole from radically discrete parts. Achieving hyperrealism through flatness. Maximum impact from the most reductive approach. Capturing a nose or an eye out of blobs, donuts, and lozenges. Arriving at figuration by way of abstraction, or in Chuck's own words, being interested in artifice as much as realism. Chuck has been referred to as a conceptual artist's favorite figurative painter, and his work has been analyzed through the lens of process-oriented minimalism. He approaches each work through self-imposed rules and formulae. John Perrault wrote about his work as follows: limitations are to be judged by what they produce. And Diarmuid Costello, also writing about Chuck, pushed it further with constraints are the precondition of freedom. Chuck has been called a lot of things. Hilton Kramer called him a lunatic, whose work was the trash that washed ashore when the tide of pop art went out. When his large portraits done with airbrush of Documenta in 1972 was reviewed by Der Spiegel, the title of the review was Asket mit Pistole, Ascetic with Pistol. He was among the artists Robert Hughes discussed in his article, The Realist as Corn God. He's an FOB, friend of Bill Clinton, that is. He's twice now a presidential portraitist, first Bill and now Barack. He is even referred to as mayor of Soho. But if there was a biblical character that I could associate him with, it would be Lazarus, for the dead come back alive. As Chuck himself said, painting must have died a number of times in his lifetime. And he hedged his bets on what he himself has listed as follows. Figurative painting, which is deader than a doornail, and on portraiture, the most morbid activity of all. After tiring of his acrylic and watercolor portraits, he even decided to return to the traditional medium of that morbid genre of portraiture, oil. Klaus Cortes wrote about how Chuck retrieved painting from exile. This is the other part of Chuck's magic, his ability to give the pariahs of art history an incredibly edgy contemporary spin. Painting, figurative painting, portraiture, in oil, even the daguerreotype, also considered dead. Again, Sheldahl. Close gives the old medium a jolt of primitive conviction. And Chuck has kept all this not just alive, but relevant and stunning. Not with radical statements or grand posturing, but plainly and thus most effectively for the works being simply what they are. I didn't consciously seek Chuck out, and I've had a pretty diverse career path. But he was in my life that moment in front of Fanny. Then as an intern at MoMA back in the early 90s, a Bruce Nauman retrospective blew my mind. Again, at the time, I had no idea who Nauman was nor who Robert Storr was, the curator. But when the opportunity to apply for a position to assist Rob at MoMA arose, you betcha I jumped at it. As fate would have it, Chuck's planned retrospective at the Met got moved to MoMA, initially to be steered by then MoMA chief curator Kirk Varnadoe, who at the time was dealing with illness and passed the task to Rob. And so serendipitously, in 1998, I had the opportunity to assist Rob on Chuck's retrospective. And now here I am, working on Chuck's catalog resume, which in its own way is like a portrait of the master portraitist. The nature of catalog resume research involves identifying, tracking, and verifying every single detail about every single work. Likewise, the discrete parts make up a whole. It's not just about an inventory of things. It's tracking everything that has happened to each work. And the evolving provenance, exhibition, and literature histories of each work continually enrich the life that it has accrued. As such, I sometimes felt like a stalker and rationalized my persistent and detailed correspondence with private collection managers and museum registrars and curators by explaining that the catalog research is much like how Chuck has described his paintings. Monumental in scale and brutal in detail. In the run-up of the long hours to this launch, something else about Chuck resonated with me. In 1995, John Guare wrote a monograph on Chuck called Chuck Close, Life and Work. His most recent monograph by Christopher Finch is titled Chuck Close, Work. And then the tandem publication, also by Finch, was a biography called Chuck Close, Life. To Chuck, work and life are so intertwined. If process wills the form in his art, it is work that wills the living in his life. Klaus Cortes summed it best by referring to Chuck's love of labor as the Protestant work ethic in extremis. A chapter in the catalog resume is titled Incremental Grids. Chuck, the magnet of physiological phenomena, has among others severe dyslexia and prosopagnosia, or face blindness, an inability to recognize the topography of a face. He found that if he broke a task at hand in parts, it was easier to deal with, and thus is God or the devil in the detail. One day it dawned on Chuck that his paintings were no different from the afghans that his grandmother crocheted or quilted. Stitch by stitch, brushstroke by brushstroke, quilt square by quilt square, grid unit by grid unit, the whole gets built. Each canvas is transformed from the blank canvas to to the completed painting, first with the grid lines, then the first layer of individual monochromatic squares, and the number of layers of what he has referred to as the corrective strokes, much like in golf. Christopher Finch once calculated that a large painting must be equivalent to 9 rounds of golf with a myriad and multiple corrective strokes in order to arrive at one hole. Sometimes the immensity of the task of pulling together the catalog felt overwhelming. But viewed through the lens of this incremental approach, it becomes less daunting. And here I have to add that these bits and pieces could never be cobbled together by one person alone. The other thing I've expressed to colleagues is how I've come to liken this kind of research and quasi-detective work to hunting and gathering details from all corners of the world, where I have kindred hunters and gatherers. This launch is also an acknowledgement of the myriad and multiple contributions from near and far, from my colleagues at Artifacts Press, David and Sarah, whose support and camaraderie have been steadfast, my super team of interns, Moss, Mikal, Hannah, Sammy, and Lindsay, contacts at Pace Gallery in research and archives, photo archives, registrars, and dealers' offices, who have given our research time and attention, to private collectors who fill out the registration forms and send photographs, not just of the works, but even of inscriptions, to museum curators, registrars, and archivists, both in the U.S. and abroad, who patiently deal with my many questions and who sometimes dig up great nuggets of information, and to Chuck's studio, run like clockwork by Beth and Manolo. Now here, I can't really say last but not least, because the catalog resume, after all, is an all-encompassing catalog. So Chuck is first, last, and most. Chuck has given generously of his time, has entertained me with his anecdotes, enlightened me with his insightful comments, and amazed me with his incredible memory, all of which critical to the shaping of the catalog. So now we go to the catalog.
Okay. So this is the home page. I'm going to click on viewing all work, which is going to load up the entire contents of this catalog. And we can scroll down, and you will see the many paintings in it. I'm just going to quickly show a couple of features. We also have the ability to hide these. There are search filters over here, which enable you to narrow your search based on date, based on medium, and based on the location of the work. We can hide that and show larger thumbnails. These are currently sorted chronologically. They could also be sorted by other criteria. And similarly, we can view this catalog in different ways. This is a slideshow view. We have a list view, and then we have a grid. So we're going to start with a work called Big Nude from 1967. Now, our catalog is called Paintings 1967 to the Present, and this is complete from 1967 forward. We have a couple of selected works from an earlier period, and I think what we'll see at a quick glance is that the Big Nude stands out from Chuck's other works. It's quite different from what preceded it, and it's also, although it launches the period of Chuck's work that we associate with that we know best, the photorealism, portraiture, it's quite different. It's not simply a head. It's a full body. And Chuck, I wonder if you can talk to us. I'm going to show some pictures in large format. I wonder if you can talk to us about the place this piece takes in your career and how you came to make it and how it changed the trajectory of your entire career.
Well, one of the things that happens when you're in graduate school is you get rewarded for knowing what art looks like. And once you know what art looks like, it's not hard to make some of it. The trouble is it's going to look like someone else's art or it won't look like art. When I first got into a studio by myself, I I was aware that the room was inhabited with all my heroes, and I couldn't find myself in there at all. So I had to find a way to purge the room of all these people. And so we may not know what we want to do, but we sure as hell know what we don't want to do. So through a series of self-imposed limitations, I proceeded to try and move as drastically and quickly away from what I had been doing and see if there was anything else I could do. I was told that I had a good hand. What I think that meant was that my hand made art shapes. I was told I had a good sense of color. I think what that meant was I'd learned that certain color combinations look more like art than others. And it's very difficult at a time in which there is some tendency going on to not be swept up in that and to sort of tag on to the end of a long end of a long string of other people's conventions or traditions. So since I couldn't make art shapes, I decided to work from photographs. So unless it was the shape that was in the photograph, it was wrong. And since I had always depended on color, I got color out of there and only worked in black and white. This poor woman was a secretary where I was teaching, and I promised her I wouldn't put her head in the painting. But
how big is the head?
Well, the head's got to be 5 feet high or something.
5 feet high.
This is 22
this
feet
is 20
long.
Feet long.
22 feet long.
But I'm 72. She's got to be a good 5-6 years older than I am. So she's pushing 80. So no matter how much she hates it, I think she'll have to think, well, you know, it doesn't look that bad. So this piece was a sort of a proving ground. I was just trying to find a way to put paint on a canvas that didn't use traditional brushes. I had a great deal of facility with brushes, and I had a history with brushes. And there was a way to use each one of those brushes. And some of them had been used successfully. So I threw away all the tools, and I decided to put paint on any way other than with a brush. So I thought, well, okay, I can spray it on. I was teaching at the School of Visual Arts at the time. I thought, well, I can take a course in airbrush. I went in, and I realized that they were making homage to an airbrush, which was, you know, just as vacuous as a painting that's homage to a bristle brush. So I decided I wanted to do everything with on-the-job training. I would just figure out how to do it. So I put on paint with rags, with sponges, with my fingers, and any way that I could. But the painting, although it was 22 feet long, back up one or two. I stop at the groin area. I wanted to make a painting in which every square inch was equally important. The trouble was, Kiki Smith said this was the first piece of body art because she had a cesarean scar and stretch marks. Not a glamorized odalisque.
Oh, sorry,
did
you turn your mic on?
I thought so.
Could you hear him from the back?
It's off.
It's
off.
Audio recording, so.
Oh, sorry.
Too bad. But could you start all over again?
Uh-huh.
You're going to come on much stronger now.
All right. Is that better?
Yeah.
Actually, if you don't mind, you can do some of the.
No, I'm not going to do it again. I didn't want to do it in the first place, and I really don't want to do it twice. So even though I wanted every square inch to be equally important, certain people gravitated towards the hot spots. So I thought, well, I better not do this. And the scale was still not big enough. I wanted a Brobdingnagian world in which the body was almost like landscape. If you think of Gulliver's Travels and the Lilliputians climbing over the face of the giant, they didn't even know they were on the face of a giant. So I wanted I figured the most obvious part of the figure to use was the head, and if I made it big enough, you could get lost in the landscape.
Should we go to the first big head? Mm-hmm. So, Kirk Marnado had referred to this as the portrait of the artist as a young punk. I was going to search punk.
Oh. Well, we can also do that.
Yeah.
If I can spell.
I was overly enamored of James Dean. And I wanted, I thought it was, look a lot tougher than I actually am. Now when I have this thing reproduced in a book, I have to do a disclaimer telling kids not to smoke, which I don't have any trouble doing since I think it is pretty stupid to smoke. These were made with about a tablespoon of black paint sprayed onto the canvas, and then very thoroughly eroded how was that?
It's I love this detail because you talk about how they're just dumb marks, but they look like hair.
Mm-hmm. Well, they literally do look like hair.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea was to try and do every man. Andy Warhol was already doing movie stars and people like that. So my desire was to to just take images of friends of mine, people I knew. And amongst the first paintings, this is what I worked from, the photograph. That's a pencil drawing. Move on to... I was in there early with the grunge look. Can we go on further?
This is a studio shot.
Go on. Oh, there's the guy's arm who tattooed my painting on his arm. Thought that was kind of interesting.
So let's also show that there's a lot of information in this catalog. We have provenance exhibition. Lengthy exhibition history, lengthy literature history. We have the ability to create individual pages. So, for instance, is this?
No. Go down. Keep going down. To the Walker. It should be 1980. Yes.
Yes. So this is an example. This is a show that Chuck had at the Walker Art Center. In 1980, and these are all of the works that appeared in that show. Plus
all the paintings.
All of the paintings, yes. And then we can return directly to this page. We also have a section here called Editor's Comments with selections from certain critical works. I'm actually going to read one of these quotes that's actually your words, Chuck. You said... it's difficult to deal with an image of yourself that size. I referred to it as a hymn. And what we're going to do is now look at all of your self-portraits And I'm curious.
It's a nauseating number of images.
Yeah.
I had a Saul portrait retrospective, which I thought, well, that's sort of interesting. I walked into the retrospective, and I really thought I was going to lose my lunch. I guess maybe my ex-wife was right. Maybe I am the most narcissistic person on the face of the earth. But, you know, you're around, you're handy, and you have to, I don't flatter other people, so I have to, I have to show that I'm as tough on myself as I am on them.
Did these at a certain point stop being a him and start becoming a you?
Well, you know, they're always a little bit you. No, I think I don't. Maybe because I'm face blind, I don't identify with even my own image in this sense. The great neuroscientist and author
Oliver Sacks
is so unbelievably face blind that he doesn't recognize his own face in a mirror. He recognizes the people who live in his apartment by their dogs. He didn't recognize his own shrink of 40 years when he saw him in the lobby instead of his office. He's also place blind, which means he can't find where he's going. He tried to learn how to go to his office and back to his apartment and ended up going around the block like 30 times before the doorman came out and got him.
Well, shall we go into a grid work?
Yeah.
So this is a grid.
It's all distancing, grid.
Yes, that's true. This is an overt grid, though. Mm-hmm. And
well, they're all made with a grid.
Right. The grid rules. And here you can see that it's really photo-based. Do you want to talk about your experience when you were just starting out and your paintings were based on photographs?
I don't know what you're getting at. Oh, maybe when I went to my first dot drawing show.
Yes, and how?
At Biker Gallery, and I walked by a newsstand, and hanging on the newsstand was a copy of Scientific American, with the first digitally arrived at image, and I thought, oh shit, now no one will believe that I made these paintings without the help of a computer. But the thing that's sort of interesting is that the program that they developed at MIT to make the first digital images was called the Chuck Close Plan. So I was first. But whatever that's worth, which is probably not a damn thing.
Now we can go to related artworks and show Robert.
That's the height.
104,072. Can you explain why the title has this big number?
That's how many squares over.
So, and when we go, yeah, we can go into the. So here it's only 154, and you can see that the resolution heightens as the number of grid units.
The first one is the size of a postage stamp. Remember postage stamps?
Yes.
And that's the minimum number of images to recognize a specific person. Mm. This is about the size of a postcard. Four times as many as the size of a sheet of typing paper, but no, I say a sheet of printing paper. And that's about.
This is 9,856.
Yeah. So there are thresholds below which you cannot comment on something and above which you can. And it was just about trying to build a complicated image out of stupid, inarticulate marks that had no particular associative value. clusters of them will make a mustache without any mark looking like a hair. And strings of them will make his glasses frames without being identified as metal. Okay?
Okay. So we've sorted these works according to some different styles. So this is a group called the Black and White Continuous Tone Portraits. I think you can see their similarity. And we have the ability to track the current location of these works. So, for instance, this work is in Australia. This is Bob. Chuck, there's an anecdote about Bob that when you looked at the painting and you noticed a highlight in one of the eyes that was too bright.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
I was working long hours. I worked basically at night, and I've been working on it for a long time. And I thought the highlight on his eye was too light. And I thought to myself, oh, now I'll have to take his glasses off.
To fix it.
You know, do it. I thought, oh, my God. When you start believing your own illusion, you're in big trouble. So I just put the tools down, walked out of the studio, went to bed. But it's interesting, you know, in terms of painting anonymous people, within the first half a dozen paintings, I had painted Philip Glass, Richard Serra, and many others. And Bob Israel was an opera designer, and I don't think, and they were both, Phil and Bob, were in the studio on the same day when I photographed them. I don't think they said one word to each other. Mm-hmm. About 25 years later, they did Sada Graya and Akhenaten. So, gee, you know, if they'd actually talked to each other, you could have collaborated decades earlier. But Philip likes to say that there was something almost magical about showing up to be photographed by me, which was it had a tremendous impact on one's career.
You just needed to be painted by Chuck.
Well, it didn't matter that I even painted them somehow. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but it did seem like everyone's career took off. But you have to realize what it was like in the 60s in New York. If you went to the galleries, you could start on 86th Street and go to 55th Street in an afternoon and see the 16 galleries that showed contemporary art. And if you had a show, you knew every artist of every stripe would see your show. So it was that kind of world. Why did so many people I paint become well-known? Because we all knew each other. And we're all doing things. We're all trying to figure out why make music, dance, art, theater at that particular moment. And we were all trying to figure out what the nature of the time was.
So Robert Israel's reaction to this was this. My reaction to the finished painting, it was very difficult for me to see it as a whole. I kept seeing parts of myself, my eyes, my nose, my cheek, my lips. I could never perceive of this image as my face. Chuck, I remember, said he thought he knew my face better than I did after working on it so meticulously for so long. And I think he's absolutely right. But his description of the painting is also related to the film, the only film that you made, Slow Pan for Bob. And
that was a film about scanning the face, where mm-hmm. you never saw the whole face. And even though you'd seen every square inch of the face, your brain could not put it together and make a whole out of it. You just didn't remember the previous pieces and then put that together with the subsequent ones. So.
And this is at the Pompidou, and it has circulated in a traveling, like, years-long traveling exhibition there. So I think more Europeans have seen this than Americans at this point.
Okay. So after the black and white continuous tone, you moved into color. Can you tell us about the move into color?
Well, it was an attempt to change what I was doing in the studio. Since I had originally purged color from my paintings, I decided, oh, look, that's Joseph Boyes looking at my paintings.
Yeah.
It honestly is. I didn't think he cared.
And if we're able to verify that this was really shot in 1974, that was the year that he did I Like America, America Likes Me, where he was driven by ambulance all the way to Rene Bloch Gallery, and he didn't want to see any of America. He didn't want to step foot on American soil. But here he was in 1974. This was supposedly in Minneapolis, the heartland of the mid, you know, and looking at a quintessentially American painting by a quintessentially American artist.
I saw him, you know, rolled up in the rug with his cane sticking out of it and the coyote in that cage about a dozen times. Hmm. Anyhow, so when I made the black and white paintings, I only used black paint, which means all the decisions were made in the rectangle instead of on a palette. So when I returned to color, I didn't want to make paintings the same way as I used to. So I decided to make paintings by layering three one-color paintings on top of each other. So there's a magenta painting, a blue painting, that makes a purple combination. Add yellow and you get full color. I couldn't figure out what was happening because all of a sudden my paintings, which had taken 3 or 4 months to make, were taking 12 or 14 months. And I realized, oh, I had to make three paintings. That's why it takes longer. So let's show them, John.
Well, we'll go through. And there's Linda. But we can go back to John. Here he is.
And let's show him. Now, there you see his eye is just magenta. You add blue and you get the purple state. Add yellow and you get full color. Can you scroll down?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So shall we move to the next decade? The 80s. Here we can see an incredible diversity of approaches to the head. You have the grid in oil, which you started in 80. This was still a continuous tone, black and white. And you did Georgia collage, and you went into a series of
pulp collages.
And would you like to talk about how you came about?
Well, you know, the... I always said that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. And if you wait around for a great art idea, you'll never do anything. But in the process of making filled pulp paper, I would drop the pulp on the floor.
In liquid state.
It was in, you know, sort of cottage cheese-like. And it was one of 24 colors from white to black, warm. 24 are cool. They would harden into little miniature chips about like a Pringle or something. I picked them up and I started making collages.
And then you had a scrim made.
The grid is a way to distribute wet pulp based on the distribution pattern in the wash. The colors let you know which color pulp to insert in each one. And that's the final multiple. So it goes from unique to multiple to unique. Oh, God, I feel so bad.
Let's go to Fanny. All right. You then did some finger paintings.
Yeah, it's interesting. People often ask, isn't that awfully hard to make an image with your body? And I thought it was really interesting that people were impressed with the fact that I did something that children do, and it just turned out looking a little different. But normally, an artist feels through a tool. You have to feel through a brush or a pencil. You don't have direct contact unless you're, you know, a sculptor working in clay or something like that. But a painter rarely has direct contact with a canvas. So it would ink up. By the way, it was oil-based ink, not acrylic.
Where it is all oil-based ink.
Yeah, but you said it was acrylic.
Not Fanny. I saw that you had, when you moved to oil, you had finished a continuous stone with acrylic and watercolor.
I know, but when you talked about it, okay, never mind.
All right. So
you can feel exactly how much ink you're picking up by the viscosity of the ink, and then you can tell by how hard you're pressing, how much you're putting on. So it actually, in many ways, was a lot easier than working with a traditional brush.
I love what you said also about your finger paintings. No one can forge them.
Yeah, well, nobody's dumb enough to make one anyhow.
And let me ask something else. You said the following about this work. I always wanted to present the image in the most straightforward and flat-footed way possible, without editorial comment, without trying to crank it up for any particular psychological reading. But I do believe that the face is a roadmap of a person's life, and that it contains indicators of what kind of life he or she has led. If someone has laughed his whole life, he has laugh lines. And if he has frowned his whole life, he has furrows in his brow. I think the picture that I did of my wife's grandmother, Fanny, was perhaps the ultimate realization that what I was doing was, in fact, far more about the person than I had ever realized myself. Now, my understanding is that you did not initially think of yourself as a portraitist. You came to that realization as...
Well, I knew I was painting heads. I referred to them as heads. And if you think of, Mirandi painted bottles... Suzanne painted apples. You don't really call him an apple painter. And so I thought, well, I'll just refer to them as what they in fact are. And given my face blindness, I never was quite sure who they were anyhow. But I wanted that arm's length distance. I didn't want to be... I often work with them on an angle or other ways to distance myself from them. And that's so I don't paint what I know to be true, but paint what I find or see.
So we've been focusing on artworks, but we could go into an exhibition, page 2. So here was your retrospective in 98. And these were all the paintings that were included in that show. And from here, maybe we can go to Lucas.
Yeah.
That was an interesting show because it embodied works made before I was in the hospital and works after I got out. And Rob Storr, well, first Kirk Varnadel was going to do the show, and then he got ill, and Rob Storr took it over. But he did me the great favor of putting work from the last show I did before I went in the hospital in the same room with the first show that I had after I got out, sort of challenging people to see whether or not they could tell the difference between the works that were made before I was paralyzed and afterwards. Most people couldn't tell.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Lucas, I understand that he posed for the photograph.
They all posed for the photograph.
So when you know, one of the things that I think is interesting in these works is that there's a kind of tension about different kinds of time embodied in the work. There's the moment of the photograph. There's the length of time that you take to make the painting, which is a very deliberate process. And then there's the even lengthier time of getting to know someone who's a friend. And I'm curious, when you look at a work like this, do you see the moment of the photograph, or do you see the person?
Well, everything you do takes you one more step further away from the person. The photograph is already one step. The painting is one more. The reproduction is one more. Most people don't really deal with art objects, even art historians. I always thought art history should be called the history of slides. Because you sit in the room and the works are rendered transparent. You have nothing, no knowledge of the physicality of the painting. You don't know the scale. Damn it. Lucas is an interesting, that's one of Lucas's drawings too. But Lucas is an interesting subject. Because if you could run for the job of Ayatollah, he would have made a good one. And very Svengali-like. So I rather, even though I don't believe in any of this shit, I never ever asked anybody what their sign is. And I don't care. But I did think it was interesting to have it emanate from where his third eye would be. I just thought it looked like spin art.
Mm-hmm. And he loved this so much more than the other one, because he thought that was proletariat and this is so imperial.
Well, then I made a rug and he said, oh great, people will have sex on my face.
This is also by Lucas. And this was a portrait that he
that
made
Lucas
of you.
Made of Chuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's go to your incremental grids. There's the working class Lucas, and there's the Ayatollah.
The working class one?
This one.
Yeah. Doesn't look working class to me.
Well, that's what he called it.
This is the czar. And the other one.
This is why he said, I prefer. Now here we can look at how variety in orientation does affect what a painting would look like. So here Lucas is concentric, as is Cindy here. And you said something very interesting about why you wanted to focus on the ear of Cindy's here.
Well, I thought one of the things that happened in the 80s was to a certain extent knowledge and information had moved away from what you see to what you hear. a lot of dealers could be said to not have had a great eye, but they had a good ear. They knew who to listen to. Hi, Jack. They were able to sort of keep up what was going on by surrounding themselves with very intelligent people they could listen to.
And then the diagonals, like Francesco here, Elizabeth, and a more recent one, and here, this really tightly cropped self-portrait. Mm-hmm. And then the more vertical, horizontal, I mean, it makes sense that you do tapestry because it's almost like, you know, the warp and the weft.
Well, the tapestry is a grid too.
Mm-hmm. But we can go into, this is a horizontal, vertical orientation.
Well, Agnes Martin, you're going to have to do her with a grid.
Yes.
The woman invented the grid.
So
there's an interesting difference. Well, she said, I wore this shirt because you're a whiz with shirts.
She dressed for you.
Yeah.
But your brain works in a certain way, and if the grid goes horizontal in rows, your eye has no trouble keeping a track of what line it is. And that means those works tend to be more sort of structured, understandable, in a way that we understand typing or printing or whatever. Yeah. A diagonal grid, it's almost impossible to keep track of what row you're on. Yeah. So there the grids tend to dissolve, mm-hmm. and the images are more naturalistic.
Right. And here
it's funny because mm-hmm. the one person that I always really wanted to paint was Saul LeWitt. Okay. So I thought, well, you know, there's a guy who knew about grids.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was because his off-stated claim was, I just want my work to speak for itself. I don't want to be identifiable as the artist. So I actually just saw Carol at the opening at Yale of Jacques' incredible new installation of the Yale Art Gallery's collection. And I said something about it, and she said, oh, no, he was just vain. He was afraid. He was just afraid that he wouldn't look good in the paintings.
Well, didn't Alex Katz say that, look, I have a very beautiful nose, and what did this guy Chuck do to it in one of his paintings?
Well, I was walking out of my shrink's office, and a woman attacked me on the street, and she said, Alex is much better looking than you made him.
And that last slide was a journal entry by the former director of the Harvard Museum, and it talks about Agnes Martin talking about the portrait of the Chuck made of her. And it kind of goes full circle because here she talks about how she really didn't want Chuck to paint her, but then she went to see the retrospective at MoMA, and I happened to have been the person assigned to give her a private walkthrough, and
okay.
It was seeing Fanny that made her think, oh, he can do old women well.
Yeah, she said, if you can make that old lady look that good, you can paint her.
And we were lucky enough to find this evidence, and she described it when she first looked at her portrait. She said, it's superhuman.
All right, so we're going to now go to one of your subjects who's fairly well known. Let's talk about this work, I think that in many cases you are working with friends, colleagues, family members.
I'm an FOB.
You're an FOB, but this is a man who has. With Philip Glass, you created the image. I mean, I don't know what Philip Glass looks like. I know what Chuck Close's painting of Philip Glass looks like. I mean, that is
annoying to Phil.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well.
And he famously said, "I didn't look like the painting when he painted me. 15 years later, I grew into the painting."
He was one of the many times he was married. He was married to a woman from somewhere behind the Iron Curtain, Bulgaria, Romania, something like that. And her mother came to the States to visit them.
She wouldn't believe that he was famous.
Yeah, so she took her to the Whitney, and she saw the big image of Phil. And she says, "Oh, you married a very famous man." And she said, "Well, you know, he's a very well-known composer." She said, No. "He must be really famous." Because any images she'd ever seen that big were Lenin, you know, on the side of buildings.
Well, should we go to the final film?
Should we do slideshow of Bill?
Of Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can go back here.
Okay. Oh, and we heard that when you were going to photograph Bill, you got in trouble because you went to the White House and you said, "I'm here to shoot the president."
Here it is. This is the assassination attempt.
It's funny, you know, the first go-through with the president, each tooth sort of comfortably fit into one of the units, and it looked like he had a mouthful of chiclets. So, can you get a large blob of it? His mouth. Zoom in on that.
Unfortunately, we don't have.
Yeah, we don't have the detail of that.
Anyhow, I ended up with this kind of schmoo-like shape. None of you remember
this part.
Little Abner, but a schmoo was this white thing. But I had to make it less like teeth to make it look like teeth. And his eyes were a constellation around a orbiting around this very intense dot. And anybody who ever was in the same room with Clinton, he made you feel like you were the only person on the earth, the only person who mattered. And when he zoomed in on you, that was it. Even my daughter, who was about this big at the time, kept saying, "Can we go now? Can we go now? I want ice cream." The president walked into the Oval Office. And she said, "Oh, my God." And it was just the aura around the guy. And he was down on his hands and knees playing with her on the rug. Something they probably did other times as well. But I thought it was particularly important to have that intense stare where you realize that. And, you know, they always say paintings have eyes that follow you around a room. That never happens. They don't really do that. But his eyes do. Mm. Wherever you are in the room, you know, he's looking at you.
The panoptic gaze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's go to your current show, which is up until the 22nd. Okay. Catch it before. And this is Cindy, the most recent painting still wet.
Actually,
kind of?
No. Actually, it's the last painting, too. I'm not doing them anymore.
Is that true?
Yeah.
What happened to Cecily?
What about her?
I thought you said you were going to paint accessible.
Well, I'm not making them the same way.
Ah, okay. So.
And now that I announce it.
You're going to have to follow through on it.
I'm going to have to do it or it's going to be. I've been telling every group I talk to that I'm not making any more of those. So if you see any more of those, you know, feel free to just
call him on it.
To dry.
See? There's the guy who's a whiz at shirts.
If you see the show, and there will be a quiz later, I have, besides paintings, I have these new watercolor prints that I'm doing, which are made from 130,000 watercolor marks that I made that became the vocabulary. That then was put into a computer, and they're layered in red, blue, and yellow, like that early painting where I made a full-color image. But,
So we wanted to end with, you know, you talked about how when you decided to paint heads, you said, well, rocks don't interest me, and I'm not all that interested in trees, but people matter to me. And so, you know, you paint family members. And
like I said, I'm glad Mirandi painted bottles.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit about bottles. Mm-hmm. What's in them?
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about rocks or trees. I'm really glad they did those things. Mm-hmm. The only thing that really interests me.
And in fact, you had an exhibition called People Who Mattered to Me. So.
Yeah.
And Cindy Sherman, whom we know to be a chameleon.
No one knows what she looks like.
Who is herself here. We can contrast her with Joe. Joe was in this decade.
Joe's the only person who actively changed the way, that's Joe Zucker, the wonderful painter, I think.
You described him
as... Who actively changed the way he looked before I painted him, so we'd have no problem.
This is what he really looks like.
This is Joe. This is Joe.
But when he found out that Chuck was going to paint him, he got a jar of Vaseline and slicked his hair and dressed up like, what did you call it? A used
Midwest
car salesman?
Yeah. Yeah, we can see what... When I went to pick him up to photograph him, I didn't recognize him. He has curly, blonde, bushy hair, but he has bought a... But he had bought a jar of Vaseline, greased his hair down, borrowed someone's white shirt and tie, someone else's glasses, and he looked like a used car salesman. He understood that all he had to do was provide me with the evidence that someone like that existed for a hundredth of a second. It didn't necessarily have to be him. He didn't have to identify with it. After the photo session, he went home and washed the grease out of his hair and went back to life as usual.
And now Joe lives in Japan.
Oh, the painting does.
The painting does.
The painting, yeah.
And,
Oh, that'll come as news to
you. Can just click right here.
And here, the Japanese version of Cindy Sherman, Yasumasa Morimura, was commissioned by a magazine there last year, and he was asked, we want you to feature rediscovering the beautiful in Osaka. And he chose this.
Oh, really?
He decided, and he's posing as himself here. Uh-huh. He's not dressed up as, you know, one of the Velázquez or, you know, Goya characters. Mm. So out of 4,500 works in that collection, he insisted that this was beautiful in Osaka.
They have phone cards and in Japan. And they have images of paintings printed on all the phone cards. Or they did. They probably don't have them anymore. But the painting of my daughter, Georgia, was by far the most popular phone card that sold, like, thousands of them for one of anybody else's.
So, Phil, you met during your Fulbright year in 64.
Yeah.
And... he is probably next to yourself the most rendered.
Recycled, yeah.
Yeah. image, and this is the most recent version of Phil?
Still has too much hair. He doesn't look that different. It's interesting because Bob Israel doesn't look that different either. Mm. Must be something about doing operas.
He did a number of musicians during the show, too.
Yeah.
Laurie Anderson.
This is Paul Simon on the right. Mm-hmm. And we on occasion have lunch together, sometimes with Phil. And we always talk about process. Nothing ever got made without a process. But it's interesting to discuss process with another artist and somebody who works in a different medium. He is very enamored of the fact that I build my paintings with layers, and that to a certain extent, the first pass is not going to look very much like a person, and it's certainly not going to look like skin. But he told me about, as opposed to the way he originally composed, you know, when he was with Garfunkel stuff, or doo-wop on the street, in which everything evolved at the same time, music, rhythm, all the lyrics. Now the way he works is when he's driving home to Connecticut, he taps out rhythms on his dashboard with his fingers. And he likes rhythmic changes that, I mean, he's an amazing composer. Phil Glass considers him America's greatest composer. Complicated rhythmic changes. So he works out these rhythms. He finally records a rhythm layer. And then he said, gee, you know, what does that remind me of? He said, you know, it's a really slow, dirge-like rhythm, a kind of funeral procession-like rhythm. And so he picked sort of notes and combinations of notes that were a little like a funeral dirge. And then he said, well, what does it remind me of? And he couldn't come up with an image or a storyline to go along with the with what he had done, those first two layers. So he's at his house in Montauk. It was a very foggy night, and he went to the train station to catch a train back to Manhattan. And he heard this wailing sound of the train coming through the fog. And he said, everybody likes the sound of a train. Da, 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 da. And that became the lyrics. And it was built in much the same way as, you know, I build my paintings, or a writer, you know, any incremental way of working. A writer never does anything more than slam two words against each other, a composer a couple of notes, and me a few colors. But I like the idea of building a painting rather than painting it. When I used to work all over, and something down here, something up there, a little something down there, I felt like I was just decorating the canvas. Hmm. And then there would be an area that I loved, so I wouldn't dare change that, you know. So then you save these areas. And pretty soon you have a painting full of areas that you couldn't afford to paint out. And you find yourself like essentially putting Band-Aids on the image. For me, it's much more interesting to think about it as, you know, really kind of, you know, a construction project.
Now, Philip Glass was among the artists who had repaid the honor of portraiture. Mm-hmm. And
he composed a portrait
called, well, it's a portrait of Chuck Close, and it inspired a ballet called Sea to Sea, Close to Chuck. This was performed at the American Ballet Theater, and We can show this, and we can hear a little bit of.
American Ballet Theatre's newest work was inspired by the friendship between Chuck Close and Philip Brown. In 1968,
I just saw her tonight in my doctor's office.
The Return to Theatre in 2005 have created a musical portrait of the artist. Now Yorma L.O. has choreographed the ballet set to Glass's music, featuring a set design.
It's a favor that I painted and drew him so many times, probably 120 or so pieces over the years from when I photographed it in 1968 till now. The idea that at this point somebody who was so important to me and whose ideas were so similar to mine when we were coming up in the late 60s and early 70s, and to see it come full circle, plus the involvement with dance. That's what the New York art scene was like in the late 60s and 70s. That cross-fertilization of ideas, cross-discipline, was really, really important. This is the stuff that I fell in love with.
I started thinking about portraits and thinking, wouldn't it be cool if Philip Glass wrote a portrait of Chuck Close since the early 90s. He has been composing piano etudes to explore the possibilities of the instrument. He's always played, but I think he wanted to explore the piano much as Chopin and Liszt did.
I think the music is, from my sense, is made really for dance, actually. So it's hopefully, and I might find it's going to go together beautifully. It has a dynamic. This particular piece has a lot of beauty and story in itself. So even abstract movement can be combined with that music, and it will be story.
The whole thing seems so narcissistic and self-involved that I find it somewhat embarrassing. In fact, I wanted to use images of film, and they said, "Oh no, this is a portrait of you. That means you have to use your imagery." And so I sort of reluctantly accepted that was the requirement. And then I just wanted to try and talk about what my art looked like at the time when Phil and I were just getting started, and then to try and talk about where Phil's music has gone since then. And it does seem to parallel the changes that have taken place in my own work.
This is a classical situation where a lot of artists get together and exposed to each other's way of thinking. So how those influence me when I go to the studio, those experiences that I had of these arts. So, make a combination of different art forms and see what comes out.
The costumes had to be something unto themselves, but at the same time fit in almost conceptually referencing the piece. I think there was a blending, first, of the subject matter being Chuck. He, as a person, his life, his technique in painting. Then, the element of Philip Glass's piece, the music, and how it conforms to that of Chuck. And then, of course, the extraordinary choreography.
We can go back to Cocteau and Picasso. There's all kinds of poems. Rauschenberg did sets from Ernest Cunningham to John Cage's music. This is something that we're used to. It happens to be the first. I've always wanted to do something. Thought about it. But this is the first time that I've actually stuck my wheelchair wheel into the water, I guess.
C to C will also be presented at the University of California, Berkeley, later this month.
The iconic opera Einstein on the Beach, which premiered at the Metropolitan Opera, was not a Metropolitan Opera production. They wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. The because they were as conservative as every other institution at the time. We had to actually lease the Metropolitan Opera to put the performance on. But at any rate, Phil was a plumber. He plumbed two of my lofts, not very well. and he had been Richard Serra's assistant and was like risking his hands with slabs of lead and everything else. And Richard gave him his truck. He had an art moving business for a while. And then he drove a cab. And when he did Einstein on the Beach, he was a cab driver. And the day after, or 2 days or so after Einstein on the Beach, he was driving a rather patrician, a little old lady in Upper East Side. And she read his name on the hack license. And she said, "Young man, do you know you have the same name as a very famous composer?" But that's what it was like.
All right. Well, maybe we should open it up to audience Q&A. Are there any questions?
Recording the event, so just raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you. Maybe I should ask the first question. Chuck, last time you were here, I asked you if art could change the world. This time I'm asking you, if you could do one thing to change the world, what would you do?
Well, gun control wouldn't be bad, would it? Mm-hmm. But I think, art saved my life. And some of you may have seen the piece in the Times today about the project that I was doing in Bridgeport, Connecticut with President Obama's project that we came up with on the President's Committee for the Arts and Humanities. And we were trying to figure out what we could do with very limited resources that could have the most impact. And I was talking to the group about how if I hadn't had art, I would have dropped out of school. And always said if I hadn't gone to Yale, I could have gone to jail. And that was really true. Everyone needs to feel special. And if you're not good at reading, writing, and arithmetic, you really feel like a failure. And I went to school at a time in which, even in a mill town, very Appalachian-like, except it was on the West Coast. And I had art and music each 3 times a week. So three days a week at art, 3 days I had music. I was first chair of Sox. But, so I had this argument with Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein. And they were talking about getting the scores up. And I said, well, you know why the scores went up? Because everybody dropped out of school. And the ones that are left are going to score higher than the ones who left. I said, you don't have a score problem. You have a dropout problem. Because you have such a narrow definition of what success is in school. So anyhow, we did this turnaround art program, which we're trying out in 10 schools around the country, including one on an Indian reservation, inner city, whatever. And I'm doing one in Bridgeport. And in less than a year, it has totally changed the school. It went from the lowest performing school in the entire state to very respectable grades, and no one's dropping out of school. It's unbelievably moving to see what can happen. And we integrated the arts into every aspect of the of school. I used art and doing extra credit art projects to make up for the fact that I wasn't going to be able to answer the names and dates at a test. So I would make a 20-foot long mural, Lewis and Clark Trail, to convince my history teacher that I at least cared about the material. And in the process, I had to do a lot of research to find out what the trail was really like. So I went into a class, a science class, at this school. And all the kids were like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And it was they were doing a thing on arachnids. And I said, oh, that's sort of interesting. And what they had a dancer come in, make a web out of rope, and they would climb through this web and bind up another student. Then captured. And they were doing, a dance piece. I thought, well, that's all well and good, but do they know anything about spiders? So I said, I understand that certain spiders, the female will eat the male. Is that true? Every hand went up, every hand. And they were telling me which spiders did, which spiders didn't. And I realized that presenting the material in this way engaged them in a process that meant that they were storing and hanging on to more information than they ever had. But I reject that. A lot of people say the violin is good because it'll be good for math. I don't care about math. It's good because playing the violin is good. And everyone needs to have something that they do that makes them feel good about themselves. So I'm very proud of this project. And I also think it's speaks well for the president that he thought that putting art in the schools was an important enough thing. There, of course, is no money for the arts, but because of the nature of the project, we could go to Arnie Duncan and get some. Some money from his program, go to the Secretary of Labor and get something from their program. And the crumbs that fell off the table in education and labor and commerce was enough to fund this whole project. And we didn't go out with the idea of designing it in such a way that we were going to prove that our concept was right. We really didn't stack the deck. We got musical instruments donated. We gave them to the kids. We got one music teacher and one art teacher. And they, in turn, got other teachers involved in this stuff. And within not really a whole year, probably three quarters of a year, they had a very high-functioning orchestra, a very good band. They're making ceramics. They have a kiln. They have a gallery, which they call a Chuck Loves Gallery. And they're making really incredible stuff. So I think if art can do anything, I think it is possible that it can change the world, at least in some small way.
So I'm wondering, as an artist, how you feel about having your art in a digital catalog raisonné as opposed to a paper catalog raisonné, which is the more traditional medium. And as I was thinking about asking that question, I was reminded of your talking about the abstraction from the object to the photo to the painting, and I wondered if you've thought along those lines relative to what you're doing here with Artifacts Press, or not, or any other way.
Well, as at the dawn of the 21st century, I was dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century. I never wrote because I couldn't spell. And if they'd had spell check when I was a kid, I might have written something. I now email way too many times, and I'm finding myself writing. So I'm making, surprising myself because I'm actually making work on the computer. The tapestries that I'm making, it's a very interesting thing that 250 years ago in Bruges, Belgium, the League of Tapestry Makers, somebody came up with something called the Jacquard Loom. The Jacquard Loom was the first automated process of making a tapestry. Now, that didn't mean they didn't have motors. It was still mechanically operated, but a tapestry of a Rubens painting would take, 3 years. Painting might take a month, tapestry took 3 years. The tapestry sold for 10 times what the painting did. So they're trying to find a way to speed it up, and they came up with a system in which rectangular pieces of cardboard had holes punched in them, and they were sewn together, went up into the rafters of the mill and down into the womb. And if we should put that into
The tapestry.
The rods, if the rod went through the hole, everything was attached to that rod would lift those threads up. And the ones that hit the cardboard would not be lifted up. So when they slid the shuttle through, that would put the thread under, over. So fast forward 200 plus years, and IBM is trying to figure out how to get information into its first big mainframe computers. By the way, when that first Jacquard Loom was made, the Union of Tapestry Workers burned the mill down and the loom in it. And they came from the village of Ludd, and that's the origin of the word Luddite, someone who's against progress or change. But anyhow, IBM went back to the Jacquard technology. Those were the any of you old enough to remember the old IBM key punch cards, which they said don't fold, spindle, or mutilate, light would go through the holes. And they would go chung, 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 chung down into the computer. My primitive cell phone has more memory than the entire computer that filled a semi-trailer. And even today, the binary 1 and 0 simply stands for hole and no hole. So the ideal way to talk to the loom is with the computer because it shares the same vocabulary and the same logic. So I use the computer a lot for tapestries and now for these watercolor prints that I'm making where I've stored the vocabulary of individual watercolor marks. So sometimes you have to, I may not have embraced it as early as some people, but it's really, is this one of them? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the watercolor print of Sammy Sherman. and that has about 16,000 watercolor marks.
We have time for one more question. I saw your hand first.
Hi. So I'm studying to be an elementary school art teacher. And, you know, there are always those kids that are reluctant. They say they can't do it. What would you tell, like, an 8-year-old about why they should care about art? Why should they enjoy it?
They're reluctant to do what? Make art?
To make art. They say they're not good enough.
I'd encourage them. I'd encourage them not to make art. Honestly, I would. The only people who should make art are people who can't be talked out of making art. Really, because you have to have a certain degree of passion and commitment, and you know, otherwise you'll just sort of be taking up space in the room.
Chuck, we love your art, we love your energy, we love your imagination, we love you. Thank you so much.
This might be.